This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Spring has finally sprung. Today, Where We Live, we'll get ready for spring gardening. Whether you're an urban, suburban, or rural gardener, whether you grow vegetables or flowers, or just want to keep your yard looking as nice as possible, we're welcoming in some experts to help. So are you a gardener? Do you have questions about planting flowers, fruits, or veggies this spring? Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live, where you can join the conversation. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us is Charlie Nardozzi. He's a gardening writer and speaker for more than 20 years. He's contributed to a lot of Gardening for Dummies books and is the author of books including Foodscaping and New England Month-by-Month Gardening. He's the host of Connecticut Garden Journal, which you can hear Thursday afternoons here on WNPR at 3:04. Charlie, good to see you again. Welcome to Where We Live.
Well, it's good to be here, John.
Also with us is Ann Rollins, who's a publisher of Connecticut Gardener Magazine, and she's a UConn Master Gardener. Ann Rollins, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And Donna Ellis joins us by phone, Senior Extension Educator at PSLA, that's Plant Science and Landscape Architecture, Integrated Pest Management Program, at Coordinator at the University of Connecticut. And Donna, thank you so much for being here as well. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
When we see a mild winter like this, what does it mean for early season gardening? You know, no snow cover? I mean, is something different this spring?
Well, things are going to start really fast because the ground has had a chance to start thawing out and start draining too. So especially if you have a sandier soil or a sandy loam kind of soil, you're going to be able to get into the garden a lot sooner.
Since we've talked about this a few times, Charlie, so here's my big question. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple different types of hydrangeas in my yard.
Okay.
And they're beautiful plants, but some of them are just twiggy messes all throughout the spring. They're just mm-hmm. these ugly sticks.
Right.
And some of them are more like bushes, and they look like little trees.
Right.
And you obviously prune them slightly differently. The one that looks like a tree, I can cut that back almost to a nub in November, and it blooms again and shoots out all these beautiful things with flowers. The ones that are like little twiggy reeds, and you know what I'm talking about, I never know what to do to make them have flowers the next year. So maybe this is more of a fall question than a spring question, but what do I do with all those sticks? They look ugly until something starts to grow on them.
You know, hydrangeas can be a little complicated because depending upon the type of hydrangea you have, you're going to prune it a little bit differently. And the first thing you have to kind of understand with hydrangeas is which ones you have and which ones flower on the old growth versus the new growth. So, for example, the Annabelle hydrangea, which is the one that probably looks like sticks that are coming out of the ground, that's the one that in the early summer you get those big white puffballs of flowers, and there's now varieties like Invincible that are pink colored too. Those will bloom on new growth. So you can cut those right back to the ground. You could have cut those back to the ground any time in the winter. And what you didn't have to look at the sticks after all. And so what will come up out of the ground will be that new growth where it will flower. Now, you can actually leave a few of the sticks there. Some people like to leave some of the sticks there for them to actually have a little more stability so they don't flop over as much. But in general, you don't have to really have them. And the same is true for those tree-like plants. Those are the paniculata, like the PG hydrangeas. I call them cemetery flowers. For some reason, they plant them in cemeteries all the time. I don't know why.
They
last a long time and they're easy, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
So anyway, they're a tree-like plant. You can cut those back, like you're mentioning, to little nubbins, and they will flower again that same year, that year, from the new growth. Then you get the mophead type of hydrangeas, like the blue hydrangeas.
Yes, that's what I've got.
That's what you got. All right.
Okay.
So if you have the old-fashioned versions of those flower on the old wood. So any of those twigs that are sticking out of the ground, you can't cut those back to the ground because if you do, you cut off all of the flowering buds.
So even though they're just little reedy twigs, they're mm-hmm. not really like a tree, I still got to keep those available so that's where the buds are going to come from.
Yes, exactly. Unless, because there's always exceptions mm-hmm. in the gardening world, mm-hmm. you're growing like the Endless Summer or those Forever and Ever varieties of hydrangeas. Those will bloom on the old wood and the new wood. So you get a 2-for-1. So you can get the early blooms in kind of early summer on the old wood. And if for some reason it dies back to the ground or you forgot and you cut it all back to the ground, whatever comes out of the crown of the plant will flower, but it'll be much later. It'll be more towards September or so.
And you have any thoughts on this? Maybe not just hydrangeas, but other things that people worry about in the springtime. Like, do I do this? Do I do this right? Do I do this wrong?
Hydrangeas are definitely a big, big question for people. Well, and then there are pests. There are voles and the vole damage that takes place. And that always comes up. But I guess we didn't have a lot of snow cover this year, so they weren't hiding under the snow, creating little tunnels. Hopefully, they just all stayed in corners and froze.
Clearly, very anti-vole. Well, we're going to talk more about pests. So. Talk more about pests in the second half. Although we did get one phone call from Lorna who wanted to ask a question of you, Donna, about Japanese beetles. How to keep Japanese beetles away from her plants?
Japanese beetles are a pest of many, many plants, vegetables, flowers, fruits. They really have a very broad host range. There are different tactics that one can adopt. One of the best things is really to become familiar with your pests, identify them, and scout for them, monitor them. Go out into your gardens. If they're on your rose flowers and your buds, you can usually just hand-pick them and remove them. The adults won't be emerging until later on in the summer, usually in July sometime, but you can certainly be on the lookout for them, and really a lot of just physical control, removing them by hand. You can just destroy them or put them in some soapy water is a good first approach to controlling them.
And I think Lorna's question, too, is specifically about roses. Anything special about roses?
They certainly do like, to attack roses. There are other pests on roses, both insects and diseases, but Japanese beetles certainly have a preference for them. I would really just scout and monitor and try to look for them and just move them by hand.
Lucy asks about the Globemaster Allium. I've never heard of the Globemaster Allium. Do I need it to plant new bulbs every year? Spectacular the first summer, but runty the following 2 years. The Globemaster Allium, Charlie?
We can both jump in. But yes, the Globemaster is that big purple allium, and usually you don't have to replant it. It'll come back consistently year after year. Now, if it's reducing in size, what might be happening is that if you did dig up that bulb, you might see little bulblets or little baby bulbs kind of around the mother bulb, and that might be kind of sapping some of the energy. So after a few years, if that's happening to you, you might want to dig up that bulb, separate off the little baby bulbs, replant those somewhere else, and put the mother bulb back in with a little fertilizer. And that might help it come back to that size.
And is that the sort of thing, though, that you can do in the spring? I mean, is that what you're looking for, to do some of these transplantings in the spring and break up bulbs, or is that another time of year?
No, that would be another time of year. Your spring flowering bulbs get planted in the fall, generally. So at that point, you could, I guess, any time after the foliage matures on a bulb in the late spring, in the summer, when it turns yellow, you could pull the bulb out. You could separate off the little bulblets and, I guess, replant them, right, Charlie?
Yeah, you could replant them, exactly. Right. It'll take a number of years for those bulblets to turn into anything other than this, like, little grass-like plants, but you're not killing
except
them.
Except the daffodils in my yard would keep coming. But so you want to take care of that, not in the spring.
But that is something that I think a lot of people are looking for. They plant these beautiful perennials and they think every year it's going to be the same, or they're going to grow and spread throughout the years. And then you start to see this diminishing. Is this a common thing? And is it anything that people are doing wrong, or is it just something having to do with the plant, maybe the conditions, Charlie?
It's a lot of different possibilities of what's going on with that. It could be a plant that's in the wrong location, too much sun, not enough sun, wrong kind of soil, and so it's kind of struggling to survive and slowly kind of losing its resources over time. It could be a plant that maybe would not be hardy enough here. It really should be in a warmer kind of zone, so it gets a lot of winter kill and really kind of struggles. So, it really depends on the kind of plant, and that's what's always very important when you go to buy plants, to do a little research about them, find out if it's the right plant for this location, and also find out what conditions it needs to thrive, because some plants will kind of shrink over time, others will become almost invasive over time. So you kind of need to know what kind of plant you're putting in the ground.
Are we starting to see our zones change because of the effects of climate change, the fact that temperatures are slowly rising? We're seeing certainly very different winter conditions over the years. Is it changing our zones, Charlie?
Actually, they redid the USDA hardiness zone map a number of years ago, and it reflected about a half a zone shift. So everything is a bit warmer than it used to be. But what also is, I see, happening is that we're getting very erratic weather. So you're getting everything from mild winters, and all of a sudden we get, I love this term, the polar vortex. Swooping down from the Arctic. And so that really drives plants crazy because, it's nice and mild, and all of a sudden it dips down to minus 10 or minus 20, and that can cause a lot of problems with plants.
We got an email from Lauren. When can I transplant a lilac and butterfly bush that I never got a chance to move last year?
A lilac and a butterfly bush?
A lilac and a butterfly. I guess two different plants.
Yeah.
Okay, transplant, lilac. Well, it's spring flowering, so
right.
You probably don't want to touch it right now. You do it after it flowers.
Yeah, after it flowers, or, you know, it depends upon if you want the flowers. If it's a type of lilac that's kind of been struggling or it's gotten really too big and you're going to cut it way back anyway, then you go ahead and just do it now. But if you're trying to get some flowers this spring from it, yeah, you probably want to either wait till after it's flowering, or you might even wait till, depending upon where it's located, more towards the fall, where you can maybe root prune it in the fall and then move it really late winter. That's another way to do it. Okay. And the butterfly bush, just quickly, that's something that blooms on the new wood. So you can actually move that now would be a good time to move it somewhere, put it in, and then it'll send up new growth and you'll get flowers in the summer.
Let's get to a quick phone call from Larry before our break. Hi, Larry. You're in East Haven and you're on Where We Live.
Yes, I was calling in regards to knockout rose bushes. We have four knockout rose bushes, which are kind of drabby and looking dark and brown right now. When can I trim those? And I'd like to shape them a little bit better.
He wants to shape his knockout rose bushes a little bit better, Charlie. What do you tell him?
Well, you can trim them now if you want. And usually when people trim rose bushes or any kind of shrubs, what they end up doing is they do a lot of little snipping around the tops, which is really not how you should do it. You should really take out main branches that kind of go back to some of the trunk branches so that you can have a better structure of the plant. So if you can envision it being more of an open plant versus something you just kind of trim like a hedge. And that would be the best way to create more of the flowering wood that will come off, and so you consequently get better flowers.
What do they say? Take off the oldest third?
The oldest third of it. Yeah.
Right. We're talking about gardening with gardening experts today, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about invasive pests, those nasty pests that come into your garden. Our guest, Charlie Nardozzi, is hosting a Gardening in Castles of England and Wales tour in July. You'll actually see the Downton Abbey House. You can register at gardeningwithcharlie.com. Find out more on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. We're talking gardening here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're getting ready for spring with some gardening experts, the host of our Connecticut Garden Journal, which you can hear Thursday afternoons here on WNPR's Charlie Nardozzi. He joins us in studio today, along with Ann Rollins, who's publisher of Connecticut Gardener magazine. She's also a UConn Master Gardener. And Donna Ellis from the Plant Science and Landscape Architecture Program at the University of Connecticut. Ann, first of all, what is a Master Gardener?
A master gardener is somebody in Connecticut, at least, who is certified by UConn Extension. Having gone through, I would want to say, 3 months of training in the classroom and a number of hours of outreach and office hours with the Extension. So I guess they are considered to know how to direct people to find out what the answers are to the questions that they ask, because nobody could ever know everything that they need to know and have it at their fingertips to tell.
Donna, what else can you tell us about a program like this and who takes part in the program?
It's an excellent program. I've been one of the instructors for about 10 years for the invasive plant lectures. The topics range from all aspects of growing healthy plants and learning what the pests are. The master gardeners really, they have a very large notebook. There's a lot of material. They collect plants. They do a lot of hands-on diagnostics. They work with the public and all kinds of specimens that come in. It's really a great way to learn about what's going on in our Connecticut gardens and how we can help the public.
Well, Donna, you mentioned invasive plants, so I want to go to you next. Maybe you can give us a state of the problem with invasive plants here in Connecticut. How bad is it?
Invasive plants have been in Connecticut for quite some time. We have an official state list of 97 non-native species that have been introduced via intentional introduction, some accidental introductions, and these are plants that may have started in a backyard garden where they are cultivated and tended by all of us gardeners, but what happens is they escape cultivation, they become naturalized, where they start to grow with their growth unchecked in natural areas, and these could be woodlands, wetlands, meadows, and the big picture and why we're most concerned about invasives is that they outcompete our native plant species, and that reduces the value and quality of wildlife habitats.
So maybe you could give us an example of a few of these invasive plants that people might very well have in their garden right now. Maybe even bought them from a big box store and thought, that looks pretty.
Some of the plants can be purchased in box stores and other locations, but many of the plants on the list are commonly occurring. They can be in our backyards. This could be Oriental bittersweet, which is a woody vine that may be growing small and undetected for a couple of years, and then it starts to wrap around our desirable trees and shrubs, and it can ultimately choke them. Another plant would be garlic mustard. That's a two-year life cycle. The leaves actually smell a bit like garlic when they're crushed, but this is a plant that can really rapidly fill in woodland areas, but can certainly be in our gardens.
Charlie, do you see that there's a lot of problems with people actually introducing some of these invasive species into gardens, or is that something that people are being more mindful of over time?
Well, I'd like to think people are being more mindful of it. And, through UConn and through other resources, they're learning more about what are native plants, what are invasive plants, which ones should you actually be growing, which ones can you substitute out. And I think that's really the key, is finding native plants that are good substitutes for the ones that they want to grow, to have that big vine, for example, like Donna was talking about. So they have the same aesthetic effect that they're looking for, but they're not introducing something that could be harmful to the environment.
We have another question about a pest from Helen. Please talk about humane ways to keep deer away, Donna.
Oh, boy.
Good luck, Donna.
That may be a better question for Charlie. I mean, there are different tactics to approach. Some may try to select deer-resistant plants in the garden. I mean, deer will pretty much munch on anything if they're hungry enough, but there are certain plants that they may stay away from. Sometimes some of the more aromatic leaves, perennials, they may choose not to feed on. There's some shrubs like Lakothawee and things like that. As far as the repellents, I may have passed that on to Charlie if he has any comments, because there certainly are a lot of products that have all kinds of ingredients in them.
Humane ways. We're not talking about, just reasoning with the deer, talking with them, Charlie,
right.
Asking them to leave
going
nicely.
To mediation.
Yeah, exactly. So you've actually got some products maybe in mind?
Yes. Well, if you're going to use repellent sprays, deer are smart and they get used to things pretty quickly. So what I've seen successfully used is that people get maybe two or three different products with different active ingredients in them, whether it be garlic or rotten eggs or whatever it is, and rotate those around so that the deer don't get used to one scent or one smell or one taste. Over time. There is one product that I've used pretty successfully, has had some research behind it. It comes from Sweden, of all places. It's called Plant Skid, and Skid is spelled SKYDD. It's a Swedish word meaning protection. And they've used this out in the forests in Sweden and had really good success with it for a number of months from one application. And fortunately, though, when you spray it, it smells bad. It's slaughterhouse waste. So you can imagine what it smells like. It does dissipate pretty quickly, but I will warn people that when you spray it, it smells like that. But it does seem to be pretty effective, and it does keep the deer at bay a little bit.
But isn't that part of the problem? I mean, sometimes the things that we put in our garden, I know that there are certain organic fertilizers that are out there, mm-hmm. that they're really, really good for your plants, and they smell really bad, and I'd like to, spend time in my garden. I don't necessarily want to be repelled by it. I mean, is it part of the price we pay, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Well, some of these products, like the one I just mentioned, they do smell bad, like I said, for the first day, but then after that it dissipates and you really don't smell it much after that. But it has enough of a residual effect that the deer still sense it's there. But if you have a dog, for example, you probably want to keep them indoors if you're spraying them, because they go crazy. It's like, wow, what's going on?
Yeah, they probably love it. Let's go to the phones again. Jackson Watertown. Hi there, Jack.
I have a constant problem every year with Japanese knotweed. Looks almost like it's in the bamboo family. And Roundup doesn't seem to control it. I just wondered what other options there might be for controlling this very aggressive, invasive plant.
Thank you for the question. And boy, Donna, it is an aggressive, invasive plant. Before I listen to your answer, I will say that we've talked before with the great New Haven chef Bun Lai, who spends a lot of time cooking with invasives, both invasive plant and animal species. And if you get the little tiny shoots of the Japanese knotweed, it's actually very, very nice to cook with. But let's say you're not doing that and you've just got acres of it next to your driveway. What do you do with this Japanese knotweed?
Japanese knotweed is definitely a challenge. Of all the inquiries that we've been getting into my office and my colleagues, that is the number one invasive plant that is actually overtaking questions for Oriental bittersweet because it's becoming more and more pervasive around the state. With Japanese knotweed, it's important to understand how the plants grow. They not only have massive and very vigorous above-ground growth with the stems that are produced that can shade the, you know, the soil and keep other plants from growing, but underground they have rhizomes, which are underground creeping stems. And a small piece of a rhizome, an inch, is all you need. If these root, these rhizomes are broken in pieces, they can fragment and start new plants. So it's important to be aware of how the plants are moving and spreading. And then they also have seeds to, you know, to add to the misery. There are different things that you can do. Some people have had success with cutting the plants, cutting the stems, let them come up, you know, couple of feet, cut them down 3 to 4 times a summer, and repeat that process for up to 3 or 4 years. And if you are, you know, diligent about cutting the plants down, you should be slowly stressing those roots, and that means that they're not as a bit able to, you know, put up new shoots and continue to grow over time. That's one solution. Something else that can be done, if you have a solid patch of Japanese knotweed and it's a very sunny area and there's no other plants in that area, you can cut the plants quite a bit during the summer, and then for the 6 hottest weeks of the summer, do a final cut and cover that area with plastic, either black or clear plastic, anchor the edges around, and then let that area solarize where the sun will heat it up under the plastic, and that can possibly kill or at least injure the underground growing parts.
That sounds really extreme, Charlie, but it sounds like a really nasty invasive, huh?
It's a very nasty invasive. Yeah, it's very aggressive. It's very hard to kill, as Donna is saying. So you have to be stronger than the weed, is what I usually say it for weeds like that, and gout weed and a number of those really aggressive types of weed. You have to be very diligent to do it for a number of years. But if you're tougher than the weed, you can actually outlast it.
Okay, well, here's another weed that a few different people, Lauren and Fred, have both asked this question about poison ivy. Lauren says, my poor husband insists on ridding our backyard of the poison ivy that grows like a carpet in certain areas of the yard. Is there an easier way? I would prefer not to spray because we have a well water system. Is there a better time to pull it than others? So that's Lauren's question. Fred was wondering about a whole acre of poison ivy that he's got to deal with. What do you say to them, Donna?
For poison ivy, one of the first steps is to make sure that you identify. Poison ivy can be very confusing in the landscape. It can be a hairy vine that's growing up a tree, and then that vine puts branches out where it looks like your tree is a poison ivy tree, but it's actually, you know, part of the vine growing. I think what many of us are dealing with in our landscapes are when poison ivy is acting more like a ground cover, sort of a low-growing, you know, woody vines. So it's real important to know where those vines are. If you do your control in the winter, you really are not sure which is poison ivy and which may be another kind of vine. So you may want to wait until the leaves start to come out. Also, when we think about that phrase, leaflets 3, leave it be, to identify poison ivy, the leaves can be green, they can have a reddish tinge, they can be sort of a bit shiny or dull, so it really can look different depending on where it's growing and how much sun it's getting. Vines can be cut, they can be pulled, but certainly take precautions. You know, make sure you're wearing gloves and you're covering up any parts of your skin that might be exposed if you are sensitive to it. You can, you know, put the vines in bags. I sometimes will take a bag and invert it like a newspaper bag and sort of put it up my arm and then grab the vine and then just, you know, wrap the plastic bag around the vine so I can minimize exposure to it.
Yeah, it's made a few summers of my life incredibly, incredibly miserable, and it can do that. And Charlie, the oils stay on your skin or they stay anywhere that they touch for a long time. So let's just say you use the gloves that Donna's talking about. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that those gloves are washed off pretty well because what's on those gloves will stay on those gloves for a bit.
Exactly, yeah. And that oil is active, you know, 12 months of the year. So if you're out there in the winter and you break some of those branches inadvertently and get some of that oil on you, you can get poison ivy and February and March, even when there's not leaves out there. So, yeah, if you're working, just like Donna was saying, if you're working with poison ivy, you really need to wear clothes that you're going to wash everything afterwards. So after working with it, go into the house, strip down, throw it all in the washing machine, and that's going to be the best precaution. And also wash your hands, wash your face with soap to try to get that oil off and really don't have any opportunity to leave it on your skin.
I'd go so far, I would just take everything off and just burn it.
Oh, you can do
just
that too.
Just burn it. Let's go to Tim in West Simsbury. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I have a large older lilac bush that used to flower beautifully and flowers no more, and I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do to save it.
That's a great question, Tim. I actually have a similar thing, a lilac bush that sort of has just, it's now just a pretty bush, and it just doesn't do anything really spectacular anymore.
Yeah, well, what happens with lilacs as they grow older, unfortunately, trees around them or areas where you're living provides more shade for them. So if you start getting a shadier and shadier location for a lilac, it'll decrease in flowering. So because lilacs are such a long-lived shrub, that often happens in landscapes. So one of the things you have to look at is how much sun is getting on that lilac. You really need to have 6-8 hours of direct sun on it to get the best flowering that you can get. If that's what's happening there, you might want to consider either pruning some of the limbs of those trees around your property to provide more light, or going with another shrub. If it's really shady there, maybe you should be looking at things like rhododendron, for example. But if it is getting a lot of sun and it's still not flowering, you can always cut those way back, because lilacs are very forgiving about a good whack back. So you can cut them back to right to the ground if you really want to, or maybe 3 or 4 feet tall. You can remove some of the older branches and do what we call a rotational pruning, taking a third out every year. And over 3 years, you kind of change the whole bush into some new branches that are growing up. And that may rejuvenate it enough to get some new growth and some new flowers.
We got a Facebook question from Pam who says, I would love to install a pergola and grow climbing roses on it. My question is, how do you handle the shrub once it's established and the structure needs repair and maintenance? Do I cut the shrub all the way back low to the ground?
Yeah, I think you're going to have to do that.
Yeah.
The first thing is, of course, if you have any structure for something like a wisteria or a climbing rose, something that's going to be long-lived and very aggressive, make sure it's a big structure, you know, good-sized timbers that are rot-resistant, so it's going to last a long time.
With the Connecticut Gardener magazine, and what sort of questions are people really the most fascinated with? I mean, are you hearing some of the questions today that you get an awful lot?
Or hydrangeas.
Hydrangeas, certainly.
Roses.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, definitely.
But are there some other things, too, that people are just fascinated with or maybe cause them problems over the course of the year?
I think we've heard a lot of it. The native plants, people do want to know what to plant for native plantings. They want to know what to plant for pollinators. That's becoming a very big subject, very important subject that we need to take care of.
Well, you know what? Actually, when we come back from a break, we're going to talk about pollinators, maybe more about native plants as well. You can email Where We Live at WNPR.org, or if you're on Facebook and Twitter, find us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. On tomorrow's program, Barbara Bradley Haggerty is an award-winning journalist and former NPR correspondent. She's also author of Life Reimagined, a new book aimed at helping readers navigate the trials and the opportunities of midlife. On the next Where We Live, we'll talk to Haggerty about her book and take your comments and questions. Hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about gardening with Charlie Nardozzi. He's the host of Connecticut's Garden Journal, which you can find out more about at gardeningwithcharlie.com, also at WNPR.org. We're also joined by Ann Rollins, who's the publisher of Connecticut Gardener magazine. She's a UConn Master Gardener. Donna Ellis from the Plant Science and Landscape Architecture Program at the University of Connecticut is here as well. Let's go to the phone. Walter in Hamden. Go ahead.
Well, I've got a concern about my mountain laurel in my garden. Every winter they seem to lose their leaves. They get all spotted, maybe some kind of fungus. They seem to grow back in the springtime, but I'm wondering if there's anything I can do in the fall, perhaps, to protect them from losing their leaves in the winter.
It's a really good question. These are all questions like coming from my yard, Charlie. So thank you, Walter from Hamden. Go ahead, Charlie.
Well, it is a broadleaf evergreen, so the leaves are transpiring moisture all through the winter, regardless of what else is going on. So if you can protect those leaves from drying out, especially with the drying winds, and depending upon your location, if you have a site where you're getting a lot of westerly winds or northern winds, you can dry those leaves out pretty quickly, and that's where they'll brownen. So what I usually suggest is that get 4 stakes, as long as it's not too big of a bush, but put 4 stakes around the shrub and wrap it with burlap. But the key is don't let the burlap sit right on the leaves. Have a little space between the burlap and the actual plant. And the burlap will actually break the wind enough so that you won't get that drying out effect. And that should be hopefully enough that it'll enable it to survive.
This is what happens sometimes when I just make an offhanded joke. You were talking about the winds, and a number of people, Charlie, have said, I made a joke about burning my clothes after working in poison ivy. And they said, but don't burn poison ivy.
That's
because
right.
The smoke gets in the air and it causes all sorts of problems. So please explain to people that you shouldn't burn poison ivy.
You shouldn't burn poison ivy. So if you are ripping it out by hand, like we've been talking about, do put it into bags, like Donna was mentioning, send it off to the landfill, but do not burn it because it does emit all of that chemical into the air and people can breathe that and can cause a really severe reaction.
Our other caller actually had a quick poison ivy question. Are there people who you can hire to just go in and do poison ivy remediation? Just SEAL teams who do this stuff?
Yeah, if you're a rare person who does not get affected by poison ivy, and I hear that they do exist.
Yeah.
I haven't met them, but I hear that's a great job opportunity for them. They could hire themselves out to clean up poison ivy in your backyard.
There is somebody down in Fairfield County, I think, who does it. And I can't remember the name. I'm so sorry, but they have a series of gloves and bags and everything else that they use to go in and grab it and take it out and get it out of your property without any damage to them.
There you go. Hire it out.
Well, I was going to say, so we'll try to find out more information. We'll pass it along if we can. You know, Donna, a huge issue, we mentioned this before, people's concerns about pollinators. As we talk about controlling the pests and everything else, we want to make sure that the bees are thriving. What can we do to help our bees?
Plant flowers, and any plant that has flowers on it is something that we all should be doing more and more of. There's so much concern with the loss of not only honeybees, but bumblebees, many other kinds of bees, but other insects pollinate plants as well, and they're so important for keeping agriculture thriving and to minimize extinction of species. There are lots of resources. A great place to look is the Xerces Society. It's Xerces Society. They have some great fact sheets. They have pollinator lists, especially for the Northeast region. You can look to see what kind of plants you want. Think about season-long flowering. From your annuals, perennials, think about shrubs, the trees where the flowers are a lot, you know, high up in the air, and we often don't think about trees with that purpose. But all of these plants will help to restore and to keep our pollinators healthy and happy.
Do you have one or two suggestions for all year long flowering so that you can get more bees, Charlie?
All year long flowering?
Well, as long as we can go here.
Until
climate change makes this Florida. But go ahead, yeah.
Well, I think what Don is talking about is having a mixture of things in your yard. So things that will bloom really early in the spring all the way to late in the fall. Everything from witch hazels to the asters in the fall. And that way you'll be able to enable those bees to have something to feed on, especially when we have this warmer weather and they're going to come out of their hives and they're looking for something to feed on. So if you can provide that in your landscape. And the other thing you can keep in mind, especially with herbaceous perennials, is to really try to use a lot of the heirloom or heritage varieties of those. Those have a better pollen and nectar content to them for the bees and for a lot of the native insects versus some of the more modern hybrids. Unfortunately, as they've hybridized them for different colors or different characteristics, like they don't self-sow, they get some sterile seed in there and the pollen is not at the highest quality for those bees. So mix in heritage and heirlooms too.
Should we be worried about bees in Connecticut?
I think we should. We should be worried about them everywhere. Yeah, native bees and the honeybees, the pollinator bees, really have taken a big hit over the last bunch of years, and it's still not absolutely clear what it is that's causing it. So anything we can do to enable the population to rebound is going to be a good thing.
Let's get to a few quick phone calls. Aaron in Coscob. Hi there, Aaron.
So I have two questions. My first is I seem to have a gopher in my back lawn, and the holes are popping up at an alarming rate. So I'm wondering, you know, we've seen him. He's really adorable. My kids love him. I would hate to put an end to this guy, but he is definitely destroying our lawn. I'm wondering if there's a humane way to handle this.
Okay, so that's your first question. I'll hang on and see if we get to. We talked about voles earlier, but this is a bigger critter, a gopher, Charlie.
gopher or maybe a woodchuck. I'm guessing that it might be something like that, which is, you know, tunnels around and it has a couple different holes. And, of course, we'll like to eat a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. He's cute, but he's bothering us.
Yes, he's cute, and most likely he'll mate and he'll have more cute ones around, too.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so that is a bit of an issue with them. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe Donna would know more about the laws as far as live trapping animals. I know that there's a lot of laws that they shouldn't do that. And it's actually not a very humane thing to do, to get those have a heart traps and try to relocate an animal, because what it does is disorient them, puts them in a habitat they're not used to, and a lot of times they actually starve and don't do well. So you might want to look for someone locally who can be can come in and, let's just say, remove the pest in that sense.
Sometime when the kids aren't around. Donna, do you have a thought?
Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Connecticut DEEP, they have wildlife biologists that are well-versed in this topic, and they can advise about the habitat traps. If you do trap one, then where do you put it? Is it part of a mating pair, and they're a baby somewhere? And so they can talk about timing and I think offer some alternatives for you.
Aaron, what was your other question quickly?
Just a butterfly bush. We had a little bit of decorative butterfly bush in the yard, and it seems to have been propagating quite rapidly. I'm wondering how we should handle that.
Cut it back. You can hack it back practically to the ground, and it will come back in full force and be blooming for you all summer. Or
wonderful.
Late summer, excuse me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
late summer.
One of the things that Anne just mentioned having to do with, you know, what to spray, what not to spray, products to use. A lot of questions are coming in, Charlie. We just have a couple minutes left, but I'm wondering if you can answer two things for us. One, people worried about, you know, what can I put in my garden that's really going to be safe, the best types of products? And secondly, what else can you tell us about native plant species so that we're actually introducing things that really should be in our gardens that are native here to Connecticut?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first line of defense is always with any kind of pest, whether it be an animal, disease, insect, is not to spray. That really should be the last thing you do. And regardless of what kind of spray, you know, we have this misnomer and this idea that because it's an organic, quote-unquote, spray, then it's safe. And that's true to a large extent, but it's still a pesticide, and it still kills things, and you still have to be careful how you use it. So I always, and there's a program, and Donna could talk about this too, the IPM program, which has a whole list of steps that you would go through, and always the last thing is to spray. So using a lot of other things, getting resistant varieties, planting the right plant in the right place, using barriers, using other kinds of techniques is usually a better way to go about it. And then if that doesn't work, then you might have to resort to a spray. And when you do resort to a spray, try to get one that's going to be as targeted as possible to the insect that you're trying to kill, and one that won't kill beneficials and other kinds of insects.
Donna, do you have a thought on that quickly?
Yes. Charlie mentioned some great things to keep in mind with pests. It's very important to identify the pest first to make sure that you're seeing current damage, that you have the pest correct, whether it's an insect or a disease. Make sure your plants are as healthy as they can be, because that will help them to ward off plant pests. Think about rotating, especially if you have a vegetable garden. You can rotate different plants. We have a UConn IPM, Integrated Pest Management, website with lots of information on pests and what to do about them. But as Charlie said, the last line of defense should be the use of chemicals and then careful selection. But there are many other tactics that you can use, physical, mechanical control, cultural control, and so on.
So the other question, Charlie, Deborah on Facebook says, I love it that it has an exclamation point at the end. Tell us about native perennials. So tell us about native perennials.
Tell us about native perennials. Well, Donna, again, could probably talk to this better than I, because there are lists of natives that are native to New England, native to Connecticut, that will grow really well here. And it's good to kind of take a look at those lists, kind of look at the plants that are on there, what conditions they need to grow, and then select those or look for those in garden centers. And the more people go to garden centers asking for these kinds of plants, the more likely they are to stock those plants and therefore make them available for the wider public.
Donna, do you have a thought?
Yeah, there are a couple of great, if people are on the web, you can go to the Connecticut Botanical Society website. They have lists of native annuals and perennials. There's another great site called Go Botany, and they're throughout New England, but they will tell you if plants are native to all of the states in New England. But it is very important to at least have native plants in your yard. If you want to have a mix of native and non-native, that's fine, but definitely have the native plants, which will help our pollinators. And your local garden centers can also be of great help to you.
Donna, what's happening at the UConn Garden Conference that's happening on March 18th?
We have an excellent program lined up for the Garden Conference. This will be our 14th annual conference. It'll be a full day of educational programs. We will have plant sales from Ballack's Garden Center. There'll be a nice lunch, free parking, books for sale from the authors. We have talks on organic pest control in the vegetable garden, plant selections, talking about climate change and plants, and all sorts of topics related to gardening for the garden enthusiast.
Well, Donna Ellis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Donna Ellis, a senior extension educator at the Plant Science and Landscape Architecture Program at the University of Connecticut. Now, Charlie Dardozzi, you've got a thing coming up, gardeningwithcharlie.com. www.wherelylive.com is your website. You can find out more about your regular series here on WNPR Connecticut Garden Journal on WNPR.org. But tell us quickly about this gardening tour that you're doing to England and Wales.
Yes, we're going to England and Wales in July. So we're going to head over to London and go to the Hampton Court Flower Show, which is the largest outdoor flower show in the world, bigger than the Chelsea Flower Show. And so we'll be visiting that, and as well as some other gardens around the London area, very famous gardens like Kew and Wisley Gardens and Sissinghurst Castle, all with the idea of hanging around London because we have a special invitation to go to Highclere Castle, the home of Downton Abbey.
Wow.
And not only will we go there and get a tour, but we'll have tea with Lady Carnarvon, who is the owner of the house. So we'll learn all about the history, her family's relationship with it, filming of Downton Abbey there, all of that will happen. Then we head up towards Wales. We'll stop at an organic research garden. We'll go to a David Austin Rose Garden, end up in Wales, in northern Wales, in the Snowdonia area, go to a few gardens there. And to top it all off, we're going to go visit some private gardens. We've made a connection with some private garden clubs up there. And so we'll go to some home gardeners' gardens, you know, like you and I would have, and to talk with them about what it's like to garden in Wales.
What to do with your hydrangeas, right?
Exactly.
Charlie Nardozzi is the author of several books. He's also the host of Connecticut Garden Journal, which you can hear Thursday afternoons at 3:04 on WNPR. He does the same sort of thing for Vermont Public Radio. You can find out more about him at gardeningwithcharlie.com and also at WNPR.org. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Great to be here.
Also, thanks to Ann Rollins, who's publisher of Connecticut Gardener Magazine. You can find out more at congardener.com. And great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
If you've got more garden questions, you can send them to WNPR.org/where we live. I'll send them on to Charlie because I don't know what the heck to do. Our program today was produced by our executive producer, Katie Talarski, with help from Kyone Wolf. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.